Another interesting show. We're going to be talking about UFOs in World War II, military encounters with UFOs during World War II with Keith Chester, our guest. He's going to also talk about some of the different things in his book, Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs During World War II. Some interesting stuff, I'm sure. He was inspired to write that after talking with Leonard Stringfield, which I'm sure many of you recognize that name. An American flyer and ufologist who had an experience with a UFO near Japan quite some years ago, I'm sure. Tonight, if you'd like to ask a question, we'd love to hear from you. If you're in the chat room, you can certainly ask them there. If you'd like to call in, we have our executive producer, Jamie Havikin, on the phone, so he will be screening your calls. And we'd love to hear from you. It should be an interesting show. So without any further ado, let's welcome Keith Chester to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Grant, great
welcome.
To be on.
It's nice to have you, Keith.
So you've been doing this for a day or two, right, Keith?
Yeah, I have.
Maybe a week or two.
You just slapped that book together in a couple of weeks. There you go.
Yeah, I actually started in 1987 seriously researching. And that was a time when UFO literature seemed to have been on the upswing. The abduction phenomenon, the cattle mutilations, the gambit was really out there and instigated, or I guess it really got a big boost from Whitley Strieber's Communion, of course.
Uh-huh.
And that's what instigated my research. Seeing that book on the shelf, I just wanted to read about it, and I bought that, and bought Hopkins Intruders, and from there I just became fascinated and dove in. In 1987, by 89, 2 years later, I was able to come across a contact who worked at the Pentagon in 1970. And this particular person worked there through CETA, which was a civilian employment training agency that was utilized for college students to gain money during the summer. And this person was a teacher in Frederick, Maryland. And in the early 90s, she was telling her class about her knowledge of UFOs. And what took place was that she was assigned to the Office of Civil Defense in the Pentagon. She had all the security clearances for her position as secretary to a Colonel Sullivan, who was the head of that particular office. It was just her and the colonel who worked in this particular office. One time during that summer, other military officers were in the office with Colonel Sullivan discussing a downed UFO and occupants they had in their possession. And she tried not to listen to the conversation, but was unable to tune it out, of course, and remembered it. And when the Roswell incident broke after Berlitz and it started gaining steam, she started to relay her story. And how this relates to World War II is I wanted to embark on my first investigation. And I had not done anything like this before, but I was aware that Mr. Leonard Stringfield was an authority for crash and retrievals. I believe he coined the term crash and retrievals. And so I called him up and asked him if he was interested, and he immediately said he would help me out. He basically became my mentor. We became fast friends.
Cool.
The case didn't get very far. I, you know, was able to interview the teacher, but that's where it ended. But in the meantime, I was able to hear Mr. Stringfield's amazing account during the war. And I thought to myself, well, I've been reading now for several years, and there's not a whole lot on the war. And if his account was so extraordinary, there had to be more. So I just put it in the back of my mind that I'd like to do something on that particular topic. And by 1999, I decided to devote full-time research to the UFOs observed during World War II. And I spent 4 years at the National Archives at College Park to conduct the primary element of my research. And that ended up becoming Strange Company.
Hmm.
Wow, that's a lot of time you spent doing the research.
It was a lot of time.
Were you surprised with the amount of data that you found, or did you really have to dig hard to find it, Keith?
I had to dig hard. I was going there probably once a week, every 2 weeks, and I was spending all day. And I was looking into, of course, World War II records. And one of the key things to remember is the term flying saucer or UFO did not exist. And as far as I knew, there was very few documents that were available on the subject. And those documents pertain to what is known as the Foo Fighters. Interestingly enough, the thing about the Foo Fighters I like to really convey is that that was only one term utilized during the war to describe the objects being observed. And that particular term did not come on the scene until January of 1945. The war in Germany was only a few months before they surrendered. And that particular term was given by one night fighter unit, an American night fighter unit that were conducting operations out of Toul, Chez, France. They were conducting intruder missions, meant they would fly at night, look for trains, smokestacks, anything that moved on the ground. That particular unit started to see these objects, and it soon became known as the Foo Fighters, just among them. And they grabbed that name from a Smokey Stover cartoon that was popular in the 1940s with the servicemen. It was a madcap adventure of a fireman and his fire engine called the Foo Mobile.
Huh.
And that's where the term came from.
Well, when did the phenomena start? What year?
Documentation for military investigation of phenomena started in 1933.
For the Foo Fighter type phenomena?
Yes. Again,
wow.
The terminology is a big issue.
Sure.
In 1933 through 1935, the Scandinavian sightings is what they're called. And these were objects being observed in Norway, Finland, and Sweden. And what was remarkable about these objects were that though some of the sounds associated with some of the observations seemed to be of prop aircraft, there was no known pilot who was able to fly in the remote regions that these objects were being reported. There was nothing that could account for the lack of places for these objects to land, to refuel, or anything with the conventional technology of the day. So the New York Times picked up on the story. They were seeing objects off the east coast of the United States. Howard Hughes was actually contacted, wanting to know if he was flying a mission or if he was doing something, because there were not that many trained pilots. In fact, the investigations conducted in Europe indicated that they were aware of no pilots that had the capabilities to fly the known aircraft in such conditions. We're talking blizzard conditions, mountainous conditions, areas so remote that they would need to refuel with the aircraft of the day. And so by the time the war started in 1939 and the British became involved, we start to see a little bit of the phenomenon occurring. Again, terminology is the issue, and the British called the phenomenon rocket phenomenon.
Here's a couple of questions, quick questions from the chat room. Kathy wants to know, was it solid objects or just lights?
These were lights, but they were in several instances reported to be solid. The more remarkable sightings, the more as if they came out of the annals of science fiction, they were definitely solid objects that reflect a major craft in the air, one that was not known to exist, or no one knew who could possibly have constructed such a machine. Most others were lights, because a lot of the sites were observed at night. And interestingly enough, I don't know why they would be lit, but that has to do with some type of physical phenomena attached to the observations, they think.
Really, yeah, then these things would be pacing these. They were pacing all kinds of our aircraft, weren't they? Keith, they were pacing our bombers and our fighters, and was it any place? How about in the Pacific? Were there any incidents of Foo Fighters in the Pacific?
Absolutely, there was tons of sightings. However, the term was not Foo Fighter. They used the term in the Pacific as balls of fire. And there were
so the commonality would have been that they saw glowing globes like they saw over in Europe frequently, correct?
Absolutely. And they came in all shapes and sizes. There were triangular shapes. There were cigar-shaped. There were saucer-shaped. And the documentation indicates some of this terminology for the day, which was very unique. And what is more remarkable, Mr. Stringfield's sighting was during the day. His one of the few sightings that I've come across that was during the day. And again, he could not see any kind of physicality to it other than it was a teardrop-shaped object that burned like burning magnesium or something like that. That's how he described it.
Wow.
So Kevin wants to know, what did they look like over Scandinavia? Same thing? Or?
Yeah, they were mostly lights. In some instances, now my book does not report on the civilian sightings. I stuck strictly with the military element of this. But there are reports of objects that were shining spotlights down on the ground, a classic element we've seen before, like in Close Encounters.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, these were just lit objects and no real discernible wings or any kind of antennae or anything like that.
And in Europe, a lot of them they thought were like Nazi experimental weapons, and they pass it off on that a lot of times too.
Well, that was the first and foremost thought among the Allied command.
Yeah.
That within the documentation.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, I'm sure the dialogue was much different.
Yep.
And especially when some of these more phenomenal reports were being given to the air intelligence officers who were at first ridiculing the pilots.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But by mid-war, obviously something changed. The pilots who were given were being briefed were noticing that they weren't being ridiculed. However, there was no comments being made, and of course, our reports went up to Channel Command, and that's where a lot was lost.
Out of all of those reports that you've researched, which one is the most remarkable that just you were kind of taken back by? Out of all of them?
Well, regarding that, it would be the more remarkable sightings that were not in the documentation. And there were several. And I'd say, just off the top of my head, August of 1944, this was seen over Police, I believe is pronounced that way, southern France. RAF pilots saw what they thought were four objects hanging motionless in the clear night sky as they approached their bomber. What they soon realized was these lights were portholes to an object that was about five times the size of their bomber, which they were flying to Lancaster. It was motionless, hanging in the sky. There was no sound. They saw no type of exhaust. And once they got close in on it, the object took off and disappeared out of sight. Not disappeared, but literally as it diminished in size and altitude. So that is one of the more remarkable sightings, and there were several of those throughout the war. Again, these are being reported by the pilots, but when you look at the actual mission reports, those statements and that information was not reflected in them. So obviously the reports are sanitized. Again, if you were a skeptic, you could say, oh, well, they were lying, they were drinking, they were whatever.
Yeah.
But I spoke with 12 pilots who actually saw the Foo Fighters from my book. And the last thing you want to tell them is that they didn't know what they were seeing, because they knew what they weren't seeing.
Well, they're trained observers. You better hope they know what they're seeing up there.
Yeah, especially night fire pilots. They were
Of course.
And their vision was exceptional. Their observational skills were exceptional. By 45, these guys had seen everything. They'd seen the V-2. They'd seen the V-1. They saw the ME-262 jet fighter, ME-163 in operation. And it was soon when the jet fighters came on the scene in August of 1945, 44. It didn't take but a couple weeks before our P-51 Mustang pilots could outfly these guys and knew how to attack them, because they knew the flight patterns. They knew how they could react. So these were the things they knew they weren't. So while most of the pilots felt they were dealing with German secret technology, it was still unnerving them, because they had no real understanding of how such a thing could take place with the conventional wisdom of the day.
Yeah, and it had to be spooky. It had to be spooky for them, because, I mean, some of the accounts that I've read were all of a sudden, they're going along, they're doing maybe 300 miles an hour in like a Lancaster or a B-17, and the next thing they know, they're being paced, you know, and you're being, not only are they being paced, but sometimes they were orbited, you know, and so, you know, my God, if you're a pilot, you know, like, you got to be concerned about what the object is. You know, and they can tell the difference between something that's solid and something that's not. So, and when you have a crew of like 10 people and they all see it and they're all good trained military observers, well.
Yes. I mean, even if you say, okay, it's a 50% chance of they made a mistake, they still, there was a group
they saw something
there. Yes. And it was obvious in the early war that this was really startling the Allied command. And I think the most important document within my book was uncovered by two researchers out of London, Andy Roberts and Dr. David Clark. Are you familiar with their names?
No, I haven't heard of them.
These two researchers uncovered in the London archives a document that is very startling in what it doesn't say, but it shows that there was definitely something in place, something was occurring that seemed to be out of the ordinary. And in 1942, over Turin, Italy, an object was reported by a British bomber crew that was 200 to 300 feet in length, and it was traveling around 500 miles per hour below them in amongst the Alps. It had four red lights spaced equally along its body, just like that more sensational report I just told you about. Now, what's interesting is that is in the actual British report. And what is more interesting is that when that report was sent to Bomber Command in December, I'll quote, "Herewith a copy of a report received from a crew of a Lancaster after raid on Turin. The crew refused to be shaken in their story in the face of the usual banter." It was at this point we know that something was definitely occurring behind the scenes, and that definitely gave me the real initiative to dig further into the archive papers, which was very, very, it's huge. I've only really scraped the tip of the iceberg at the National Archives. And so
but it's got to be painstaking work, I would imagine, because you have to look for those subtle clues, and you got to go through a lot of probably very tedious and boring flight reports where there's not much anything mentioned. What kind of things were you looking for to, you know, kind of send up, you know, signals that it might be, or, you know, what kind of phrases, I guess, you're looking
for?
Well,
the most important thing, like I mentioned, is terminology. So I had to discern whether when they mentioned a jet or a balloon or a flare in a report, I had to look at it like, okay, is that what it looked like to them? And that's typically what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I started seeing in a lot of the bomb mission reports, there's an actual section called phenomenon where they put observations of things they weren't too sure about. So you would see something like saw a red flare, you know, at such an altitude, it disappeared, things like that. So you're thinking, well, was that a Foo Fighter? Was that
mm-hmm.
something else?
Uh-huh.
And you start to see a pattern, and it seems that that's what they were doing. They were categorizing everything into different categories, rockets, flares, balloons. But among those sightings, there was a percentage of real phenomena, high strangeness, as I would call it.
Uh-huh.
Well, we are also being simulcast through Jamie's Inception Radio Network, and we'd like to welcome all of you listeners there. There is a question from Jamie's chat room there. Did any subcrews report seeing these objects?
Like underwater
no,
subs?
Well,
yeah, submarine.
Well, that's an interesting question. To my knowledge, no. However, one of the documentation, a piece of documentation that I did locate, was in 1945, there was a questionnaire put together by British intelligence, and this was a list of questions, I believe it was 21 questions, that were asked of the U-boat crews that were surrendering and being captured. On one of those questions pertained to the balls of fire that had been observed over Germany, and they were wanting to know who or what they were, and they were asking like flak specialists, German flak specialists, which anti-aircraft, they were asking air technical people, and so that to me showed there was something going on, and I never saw other than one or two answers, but the Germans did not know what they were, or at least they
yeah.
weren't admitting it was theirs.
Well, what about ships?
So that's an interesting question.
What about ships? I mean, we can expand that to ships.
Yes, and there are quite a few naval sightings, but unfortunately those records are even harder to find than the air intelligence records. And I have to admit that the Navy records, I just didn't have time
mm-hmm.
to devour adequately. It was all I could do just to hit the air intel records. And to give you an idea, there's so much there. I could spend every waking hour the rest of my life. And I am aware of, just at the National Archives, too, College Park, there's 1,500,000 documents that are still classified.
Mm-hmm.
Air intelligence documents.
I was just going to ask you that from World War II. How much of it is still classified?
Just from
classified?
World War II.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
Why would
yeah.
it be? I mean, really?
I don't think this history books, World War II history books, just know the facts. More and more come out that indicate there were a lot of other things in play, a lot of things that may not have to do specific to combat, such as the financial. There's a lot of indications where the economic element of the war, there's a lot we don't know, took place. There's indications, if we're talking about this particular phenomenon, the UFO phenomenon, well, for whatever reason, it was classified then and it remains classified today, as we know, whatever this takes place. And I don't have the answer. I can only assume that one, they didn't have anything, but we know that's not true. Or two, they did have quite a bit of information coming in, but at the time they were completely startled by it, and they were just collecting and analyzing. And those records have, of course, disappeared along with all the other records that regarding UFOs, especially like the Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, the Roswell records are gone. So,
well,
all the records are there.
You know, you're probably right, and they're probably still classified. And, you know, it might have been, you know, one of those things where initially they started taking a hard look because the Nazis were throwing everything up in the sky that they could towards the end of the war. And, you know, and by taking a look at it, they probably found it was a lot more mysterious and a lot more stranger than they thought. And then they started digging into it a little deeper. And it's interesting, you know, because it started, you know, who knows how long it really started, but I mean, from at least the documentation you're talking about back in the 30s, you know, they knew something was going on. They just didn't know what it was, and maybe they still don't know what it is. But nonetheless, it seems like something at that point in time was certainly observing us.
Absolutely. It's remarkable to me that the phenomenon has remained so distant. It just seems to remain at a distance consistently. And during the war, it seemed to be that it was a monitoring situation.
Uh-huh.
I believe if we look at the civilian encounters, we'll see more entities involved. There are more, though. It's just more landings described. Again, I just stuck with the military because I wanted to go with the chance of finding real documentation. Of course, these were high observers, high-quality observers.
No, absolutely.
And I just felt that would be the quickest route to at least find out if there was a phenomenon that occurred during the war.
Well, if anybody in our audience would like to read more about this after the interview, be sure and pick up Keith's book, Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs During World War II. There is a book cover icon on the show page. And Keith, what's the website to get that book again?
Anomalousbooks.com is my publisher. And, of course, you can find it on Amazon or Barnes or Borders.com. That would probably be the easiest.
Here's a question from the chat room. Did these objects have any effect on radar?
No adverse effects. However, with the particular sightings conducted or observed by the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, who named them the Foo Fighters, they did not appear on radar, and that was really causing concern. They thought they were dealing with either one, a stealth technology, which was really unheard of at the time. There were pinks being experimented with by the Germans for their U-boats, I believe, in later war. But they were just astonished that they would look at an object, they would be able to see it, they were sure it was physical, they knew it was something that was apparently intelligently controlled, and ground radar and their radar could not pick it up. So that was a real strange event for them, so it didn't cause the radars to go down. Now, however, if we go to Mr. Stringfield's sighting of August 28, 1945, there's an indication that maybe there was adverse effects, at least within all the instrumentation within the cockpit. There was quite a commotion, and the plane almost crashed in the open ocean because of the sighting. What he thinks was associated with the sighting itself.
So he was piloting that plane?
Well, he was actually in the back of a C-46 transport. They were flying between the islands of Iwo and Iwo Jima, and Mr. Stringfield was an intelligence officer with the 5th Air Force. He was part of the first American troops to go into the Atsugi Aerodrome in Japan to prepare for the influx of American troops. And it was while he was between those two islands over open ocean, he looked out and saw what appeared to be three teardrops about the size of a dime at arm's length come out of a cloud bank. He felt they were intelligently controlled. And about that time, his aircraft started experiencing trouble. The co-pilot came back and said, "We're going down. We're losing our engines." And about that time, Stringfield looked out. It was about 30 seconds, and those particular objects went back into a cloud bank and disappeared. And simultaneously, his aircraft recovered, and they made an emergency landing for the Ishima.
Well, that's interesting, because that's been reported quite a few times, the effects of UFOs on aircraft and other mechanical.
Yeah, that kind of gets people's attention, you know, and electromagnetically they're control panels are all shut down and everything else. I mean, that would be very disconcerting, you know. I'm just like at the Minot bases where, you know, supposedly the missiles shut down, you know. And
exactly. That's a perfect example. Yeah. And what's really extraordinary about this is it's August 28th. The war had just ended.
Uh-huh.
They had air superiority in the area.
Uh-huh.
And whatever this was operating with ease. And it seemed to it just didn't add up to Stringfield's information he'd been achieving. And he knew of the Foo Fighters because he was looking at the intelligence memoranda that was being written through the months.
Did he or anybody else at that time find any natural answers to these sightings, maybe you yourself?
Well, a good of them were probably misidentifications of celestial phenomena. There was, of course, the St. Elmo's fire, which did occur on occasion. there were flares, and there were definitely rockets that the guys probably misidentified to a certain degree, but still there was a large percentage of things that were operating beyond conventional wisdom, in that the British in 1943, when they started the rocket phenomenon investigation, were, that's what they were thinking it was. However, they put on the end of that rocket phenomenon because they just were not sure. And they didn't understand how a rocket could turn 90 degrees.
Right.
Especially at that stage in the war.
We still don't.
So they still know. So there were things like that where they were putting it in conventional categories. The objects themselves were, you know, obviously a certain percentage were misidentified, but there were the ones that just made it into the file.
Well, here's
and I did discover the War Department. I did discover the War Department was keeping a file on the phenomena. They had it broken down into categories, so that file was obviously being generated by an assortment of intelligence agencies and groups, and it was then funneled to the War Department in Washington. So they were keeping an eye on this.
Here's an interesting question from the chat room. Have there been any similar stories to come out of the Vietnam War, or frankly any other war for that matter?
Yes, the Korean War, I know of many incidences because Dr. Richard Haynes has written a book on that. He's also, or someone I'm aware of, I'm not sure who it is writing a book on the Vietnam War sightings. So I've heard, and while I was at the National Archives, I actually met somebody who was a Vietnam vet who knew somebody who sighted something while he was in Nam in 68 or 69. So yes, but again, no one has really gone into the records for those particular times, the war records, to look into it.
Did any of the pilots that observed these UFOs or Foo Fighters or whatever, did they continue to see UFOs after they returned from the war? Do you know anything about that?
The ones I dealt with, no, but I've heard that there are some who had some civilian sightings and thought that it confirmed to them that they weren't losing their mind, that they actually saw something that was really remarkable. And then when, as the 60s came, the 50s and 60s, and Life magazine started putting articles and things like that, they started realizing, oh, my God, that's what I saw. And they were putting two and two together. Stringfield never had another sighting, nor had any of the veterans I spoke with personally.
At all?
At all, no.
When did Leonard pass?
I think it was 93, if I'm 93, 94.
Somewhere in there.
And he had never, the sighting, I found this out from Richard Hall, another remarkable person associated with ufology, goes back to the 50s and NICAP days and things like that. He told me that the sighting that Stringfield had during the war had such an impact on him. When he got out of the service in November 1945, he never flew again. He always took mass transit.
Really?
Or drove. And that's why, and of course, he spent the rest of his life researching the subject.
Hmm.
Well, you know, I just have this feeling, and, you know, you guys can call me crazy, that
crazy.
There's some old gentleman sitting around someplace who knows more than one, I'm sure, that are like octogenarians now and getting closer to the 90s. That know the whole story here, you know, that we're insiders to this, and it's just really unfortunate that, you know, we're not having these guys come forward, because it sure would make for an interesting story, because I'm sure that there's a lot more information available out there, and all those guys are sworn to secrecy, and it was a different ball game then.
It was. They took that very seriously. They had a lot of respect for their country. They had a lot of respect for their superiors. So when they were told not to speak, they didn't speak. And that's something, I guess, after so many years of living under that particular frame of mind, it's hard to get rid of. And I think Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt ran into that when they were doing their intense investigation of Roswell.
They had a hard time. Well, Stanton Friedman did. I mean, everybody has.
Sure. Yeah.
Because of that very mindset. I want to compliment our listeners in the chat room asking so many great questions. And
yeah.
Got a couple more here. This is from the Inception Radio Network chat room. Were there any USOs reported during these times?
There was one case where an object came up out of the water and flew off. These, again, there were, I've heard, but I have not seen in print, that they, there was one instance where the objects went into water. I guess the most knowledgeable person on that particular field would be Carl Feint, who wrote a book on water UFOs just recently. And he has a website called Water UFO, a very extensive website on this. And there, yes, there are many instances that the UFOs were going underwater. So unfortunately, this is all coming from, not unfortunately, but most of the better sightings are coming from witnesses. And it's so easy to be a skeptic and so easy to ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
And without a little bit extra, like a piece of documentation from a, you know, another source, that's where we get into trouble, and that's why the stories die so quickly.
Yep.
So here's another. Go ahead. If you have something more to say, I'll wait.
No.
Okay. Another question. Does there appear to be a higher level of UFO activity during war times as opposed to peace times?
I don't think so. I just think that the level of activity is reported more because, of course, there's a lot more in the air. A lot more people are looking in the air. It was,
yeah,
you know, especially during World War II, everyone was looking into the air because, of course, of all the rockets and all the jets and all the new technologies, so no one knew what was coming. And so the chances of seeing something unusual and documented was greater. But I think that the actual sightings themselves are just as numerous today.
If not more so, huh?
Yeah.
Did, I know we touched on this a little bit earlier. Do the pilots feel that the UFOs were watching them? I know you...
Yes. A couple of them felt they were being monitored. Actually,
yeah,
that their mission was being monitored, and that came from one of the sources I spoke with. And but at one point, they all wanted to shoot them down, and that was their top priority. They wanted to shoot it down. They felt it was a weapon. They were scared of it at first, then they became very just irritated by it. And that's when things escalated to the point where they were unnerved. You know, when you start unnerving night fighter pilots, you know something significant is occurring, at the very least.
Yeah.
You know, that, just to be honest with that. And never, never in any instance were they able to get in a position to combat these things because, for one, they would either disappear and appear behind them, or they would outmaneuver them. Now, this is a very significant attribute for whatever these craft were because it means if it was German technology and it was being controlled by a remote, you know, remote television or remote control, whatever, from a high-altitude aircraft, for one, that's remarkable in itself because that would have been done at night. And two, from the ground, it seemed an impossibility. And to be able to keep up with a fighter pilot doing combat evasive maneuvers and with no problem at all, that was really a new trend on the scene that if it was German technology, we were in a lot of trouble. So,
yeah. Well, you know, and those pilots knew that too. Those pilots knew, and every member of those crews, whether they were on bombers or fighters, knew that that technology, whatever it was, far exceeded ours. That's why probably so many of them were so alarmed. And I'm sure, you know, that it as then, as it happens now, a lot of it doesn't get reported. A lot of it doesn't get reported because it's a career breaker if you, you know, say that you saw something in the air.
That's right. And that's exactly what was taking place in the first part of World War II. And the pilots were starting to not report it. And the air intelligence officer said, look, we can't have this, you know, to themselves. We can't afford these guys not reporting what they're seeing in the event that it is some
mm-hmm.
type of technology on the scene. So then that's when the attitude changed. And by 1943, 44, some of the veterans start talking about, I can't believe it. I walk in, I give a report that really was out of the annals of science fiction, and it's as if I just reported seeing a balloon. And they just took the report, thank you very much, and that's the last they heard about it.
You know, I have my own thinking on this next question, but I'd like to get your input. You know, you look at the rise in UFO reports, which really started a lot. They really greatly increased during World War II. What do you attribute that to? What do you think? Just you feel free to speculate if you want.
Well, if I'm looking at it through the eyes of it's something not from this earth, then it appears to be that it may have been a situation where whatever is piloting these vehicles or wherever they're from, whatever is taking place, they're monitoring this great event, this great violent event, and they whatever it was did not seem to want to intrude or to do anything but monitor. And I hear that from the veterans, that they felt like they were being watched and monitored after the initial fear of it was going to be something that was going to draw anti-aircraft fire or flak. But if you look at it through the skeptical eyes, that it was German technology, that we don't know to this day what was brought in from the German archives, the scientists, the laboratories, and it's being exploited today, that's another way of doing it. But I tend to believe, if I look at the more extraordinary sightings and how many there were, that we're dealing with something that's very, very unconventional and likely not from here.
Well, you know, it kind of exploded during World War II, and it hasn't stopped yet. But prior to that, and I know there were sightings prior to that, but and I realized that there was a lot of heightened awareness for the skies and all that, but, you know, it seems like all of our best cases stem from that period, and I'm with you. I mean, if we were being monitored anyway, just not terribly actively, look at what World War brought in. I mean, yes, World War I, we had planes, but they were so primitive that, you know, they weren't that big a deal. But look at World War II, you know, look at all the advancements and obviously greater technology, more countries, if I understand it correctly, were involved, and also the atom bomb development.
Well, it sure would be nice if you were a scientist in some far-flung future to actually be able to go back and observe what happened.
Oh, my goodness, yes, yes.
If you could go back, whether it's, you know, virtually, or go back however and observe history unfolding, what an exciting concept.
Yes. I mean, it would be great to be a fly on the wall for that situation, or just go back and be able to
monitor.
Yeah, to monitor. I mean,
and know that whatever, however your technology presented itself, whatever monitoring device, it's going to, like, be so far-fetched in their minds that they're going to dismiss it.
Right. Now, you know, it's one of those things where you mentioned the atomic bomb, and that is something that's brought up periodically. I've seen it through the decades in the literature, that many people believe that's what instigated the influx of sightings or whatever, whoever it is coming here to visit. They, for some reason, that seems to be the point. Even Mr. Stringfield felt that that's what we were dealing with. It was the atomic bomb testing that started all this. And unfortunately, I was unable to show Mr. Stringfield all I had accumulated, because I didn't even start research until years after he passed. And again, he thought it was really something that was 1945,
right,
based on the atomic bomb.
But obviously, so with the Foo Fighters, it was prior to that.
Right. And not by much. It actually,
right,
you know, December 44 for that particular thing.
But, you know, just to go back, if you were a future anthropologist, that's a monumental turning point in the history of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
The you know, the explosion of atomic bomb, and you know, that's as much as like landing on the moon. Oh, that's a giant step, you know, and a giant step probably in the wrong direction, because it was used as a weapon instead of for peaceful purposes. But it certainly makes you wonder. It certainly makes you wonder, because of all of the observation that continued, it seemed, after the war, like at Roswell, because the 509th Bomb Group was an atomic bomber wing, I believe, weren't they? Were they not, Keith?
The only ones in the world at the time who could deliver an atomic device. So, and of course, everyone there at Roswell was handpicked, down to the kitchen staff. I mean, it was a high level security facility, and that one little piece of information alone is enough to make you wonder why the air intelligence officer for that unit would think he wasn't handling something that was a balloon.
Marceau.
So, yes, Jesse Marceau. So that always grabbed my attention there. That was the one piece of information that was startling, because if he couldn't identify it, and he knew what was taking place
around
him. Yeah,
that was ridiculous.
But, you know, I always like to think of it this too. It's like you're Jesse Marceau, and you get a call. You're an intelligence officer or weather officer or whatever the heck he was. Okay, he was in intelligence. He'd been there for a long time. And you get a call that something, one of your equipment went down in a field out there. And you go out there, and much to your surprise, you find out it ain't ours. It doesn't belong to us at all. And then in your excitement, you come back, because you're not the brass. He was like a major or something. And he starts telling people, they start going like, man, we found something from another world out there, you know, and yada, yada, yada. And all of a sudden it gets out, and then within 24 hours, it's completely squashed. And it was like in their exuberance to like say, like, we found something that we don't know what the hell it is. And you would have thought they would have been aware of Project Mogul or any test dummies, but those weren't dropped until, like, what, 20 years later?
It was much later. It was obviously, and he definitely was in a situation where once he had the debris and once he brought it back, American Counterintelligence Corps, who
they
were
played a switcheroo and made him look like an idiot.
Immediately. And they've made an art form. By that time, they made an art form out of deception, and they realized we have to, you know, keep this from the public. And by 1953, that's where it really became an art form, when the Robertson panel met in Washington to discuss the phenomenon. And all these are significant because the two most important people, three actually, who, if anyone knows what the phenomenon was during that time, it would have been Dr. David T. Griggs, who was the most knowledgeable, and Dr. Howard P. Robertson, and Dr. Luis Alvarez, who was instrumental in designing the firing cap, or the device to trigger the atomic bomb.
Yep.
He was one of the people who did that. And these three people are acknowledged as being the most knowledgeable on the subject. And that was one of the most remarkable things that I uncovered in the archives. I did discover that that is true, that Robertson was definitely involved in investigating the phenomenon.
Here's a question from the Inception Radio chat room. Would the object in the battle over L.A., Los Angeles, be considered a Foo Fighter?
Yes, the terminology would definitely be appropriate to that. It has to say, you know, what's really curious about that battle is that the military documentation that, from the testimony, is all over the place. There were reports that there were multiple objects. There were reports that there were single objects. They zigzagged. They looked like a star. They called them silver dots, red spots of light, bright spots of light, luminous white dots. All kinds of terminology is very significant. And absolutely. So I think they're one and the same, the objects.
And we do have a caller on the line. Tiger, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
You have a question?
Yeah, I do. I hope I've missed half the show, so I hope you didn't already answer this. And if so, you know, I'm sorry. But, Keith, I have two questions. One, I was wondering if the pilots felt that the Foo Fighters were, you know, like had actual pilots in them, or were they being like remote controlled? And two, do you feel that the aliens or whatever they are have an obligation to not let the battles, the war, our wars, get out of hand so that we can destroy ourselves?
Yeah. You're coming in. We're breaking up. Can you repeat the second question again?
Oh, do you feel that the UFOs have an obligation to watch the war so that it doesn't get out of hand and we destroy the Earth?
I'm not sure we could quite catch that, Tigger. Can you? Would you do me a favor and type that in the chat room?
Yes, I will. I'll
second
hang
question.
Okay, thank you.
Big Bird's first question. Yes, the power is that the objects were intelligently controlled. That's the best I can tell you of what they thought was taking place within the object itself. It's not that it was something that was piloted. And on the second question, I really didn't pick it up either.
Hold on 1 second, Keith. Grant, are you still there? I think we're having some technical problems. You still with me, Keith?
Yeah.
Okay. Grant, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. It's breaking up real bad. Let's just give it a second, and we'll see if it passes. A lot of times it does. Okay.
Obligation. I mean,
Let's just try it one more time on that your last answer, Keith. Let's just see if it's still breaking up.
Okay. If I understood the question correctly, were they obligated to report these things? Is that what he was saying?
No, I think he was asking whether they were the pilots felt they were intelligently piloted by other whoever beings.
Yeah. And pretty much just said they felt they were under intelligent control. So that to me that there was they felt there was something operating the machine.
Rats. Grant, do you hear everything breaking up?
Yeah, I think we need them all back.
Okay. Folks, if you'll just bear with us for a moment, I don't know what happened, but I'm going to reinitiate the program, so if you'll just bear with us for just a second, we'll be right back. Sorry for the hassle. Okay, folks, we are back, and we'll try it again. Keith, you're with us, right?
Yeah, I'm here.
Wow, it is really crappy.
They've got the convention tonight.
Yeah, I know.
Really good, so maybe it's the software or something else.
Wow.
I can hear you perfectly, but Grant is breaking up. That's all.
Yeah, and both of you are breaking up to me. I don't know what in the world it is. Anyway, let's just try to get through it. I'm not sure whether it's a Skype issue or a Blog Talk Radio issue because my switchboard has now just come back up, and we'll see how it works here. All right, we'll just keep going. So the question was, are they intelligently piloted? And Keith, you said yes, that these pilots, these World War II Air Force pilots thought they were.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And the second question, does Keith feel that the UFOs were watching so that we don't destroy the Earth?
That's a good point. And I have to say Leonard Springfield, that was one of his feelings, that whatever they were here to monitor a potential disaster, and that came the advent of the atomic bomb. For whatever reason, that would indicate a concern on their part. That's what he conveyed to me. But they were here throughout since 1933 and before that, so I'm not too sure if that conflict really did anything differently for what purpose they're here for.
Okay, got a little bit of that. It's still rather choppy. At this point, I'm not really sure what to do because calling back in didn't fix it. So, without any other options, we'll just we're getting close to out of time anyway, and I think that we're probably.
Am I still breaking up?
Yeah, you're still breaking up as well. Folks, I don't know how much I'm breaking up, but we apologize for the choppiness, and we appreciate everybody's great questions on the show tonight. And Keith, it was a fantastic show, very interesting stuff. We recommend everybody, you know, go buy Keith's book, Strange Company, Military World War II. The icon is there on the page there. Somebody's asking, what squadron were the Foo Fighters? I'm not sure what that means. Does that make any sense to you, Keith?
They mean the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, named the Foo Fighters.
Okay. Hopefully that came over. All right, folks. Okay, so there's some of them are telling me they can hear me fine. So I'm going to go ahead, folks, because it doesn't do any good to just listen to me. So, Keith, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Very interesting.
Thanks, Grant. Really appreciate it. It's been great being on here. I hope your audience liked it.
Oh, yeah. It was a good interview. I mean, a lot of great questions, and we'd love to have you back sometime in the future. So you keep on doing your good work, and we wish you the best of luck.
Right back at you. I appreciate it.
And come back to us again.
Great. And for those of you who have not visited Paranexus, we'd love to see you. Come and visit us at paranexus.org and join. Paranexus is an association of anomalous researchers, including ufologists. So please come and join us. Next week, we have Nick Redfern talking about NASA conspiracies. Hopefully, you'll join us then. Until then, thanks, everybody, and have a great week.